I would not dare to give these things today unless I knew that there had been a good, solid spiritual foundation laid about knowing the Lord. Because what I have to say today is only for, it's only for converted people. And if there's somebody who really doesn't know Christ, you would look upon the things that I'm going to say today as perhaps legalistic and, you know, all kinds of things. I had somebody come to me and they said, you know, religion to me was just a lot of do's and don'ts. A lot of prohibitions. That's all it meant to me. When I grew up in the Adventist church, this is all I heard. Don't do this, don't do that. And they never really had been converted during that time until just very recently. In fact, some folks told me last night, only during these meetings, this week, have they really come to know the Lord and to understand truly about righteousness by faith. Now, I want to tell you something, friends. Unless we have that basic elementary knowledge about Jesus as our Savior and friend, unless we have that loving relationship to Him as our Lord and Savior, then these things that I'm going to say will be very negative, prohibitive, legalistic sort of things. But when you know Jesus Christ, it is a joy and a privilege to do things for Him. You don't feel like it's a great burden. You don't feel like it's a sacrifice for you to do things for. When you love somebody, you will do something for them that you'd never do under any other conditions. Isn't that right? Love makes the difference. Now, if you want to see a joyful occasion, you go to a wedding. All of you have been to weddings. I've performed scores and scores of weddings, and I've seen that young couple standing in front of me, you know, joy and happiness beaming out of their faces. And yet, there's nothing in the world more restrictive than marriage. I mean, absolutely nothing that I can think of. I mean, here's this couple standing up there and actually promising their lives away. He promises, you know, that he's going to give up all his girlfriends now. He's going to stick to this one for the rest of his life. He's going to come home and bring the food, you know. He's going to support this family. He's going to love this one through thick or thin, sickness or health, you know, rich or poor, no matter what comes. He's going to stay with this one and support her and love her and provide for her. And she makes similar promises. She's going to give up all of her old boyfriends now, you know. And she's going to love this one the rest of his life. She's going to cook for him, sew for him, and stay right with him. I tell you, that's a restrictive thing. Those promises are among the most narrow that anybody can ever make. Now, if restriction alone brought unhappiness, then weddings ought to be the most miserable occasions on the earth. Isn't that right? It really should. But I've never had a bride come out of the wedding chapel weeping and say, oh boy, this miserable marriage business, now I got to stay with Jim the rest of my life, and I got to cook for him and take care of him whether he's sick or well or no matter what. You don't hear brides and grooms talking like that. I mean, they're so thrilled and happy to stand up there and promise their lives away. Why are they so thrilled and happy? Why, they love each other. They love each other. That makes a difference, doesn't it? Now, let me tell you something, though. If you want to find the nearest thing to hell on earth, you find a couple that's married and that do not love each other. Now, you want to find something miserable, and I've had such people tell me, you know, this marriage, it's the most miserable thing in the world. I mean, it's terrible. Now, why do some people think marriage is wonderful and some people think marriage is terrible? Love makes a difference, doesn't it? Have you ever met people who thought religion was miserable and terrible and negative and prohibitive and all the rest of it? I meet them and they say, it's terrible. I don't want anything to do with it. You can't do this. You can't do that. You have to do this, you have to do that, I don't want anything to do with it. And yet you meet other people and they're bubbling over. They think religion is the most wonderful thing in the world. What's the difference? Love is the difference, friends. Love is the difference. You know, we always do this on a human level, don't we? We'll do things for people we love. My wife will prepare my favorite dish when I come in at night, when I happen to be lucky enough to be able to come in at night sometimes. And she fixes my favorite dish, not because she's afraid that I'll divorce her, but because she loves me. She wants to please me. Some people have a fire escape religion. They force themselves to do certain things because they know this is what's required. They're afraid of the fire down at the end of the road, and they're afraid they'll be cast into that fire if they don't do all the things that they think Christians ought to do. And so it's a miserable business of just trying to make yourself do something. But if you love somebody, you'll want to do it. There's a text in the Bible in Ephesians 5:10, and I'm quoting it to you now out of the 20th century translation. It says, always be trying to find out what best pleases the Lord. Isn't that a beautiful motto for Christians? Always be trying to find out what best pleases the Lord. When my wife's birthday is approaching, her anniversary, I will listen and watch and observe to try to detect what she might want. Now, she doesn't have to hit me over the head to let me know. The little women have ways of communicating these things, you know. And when I detect what she would like to have, I will gladly get it for her because I love my wife very much. But you know, friends, I love the Lord even more. And all the time, day by day, I'm going through the Bible, reading, studying, searching to find out how I can please Him. And if I find some little way that I can please the Lord, what do you think I ought to do? I ought to do that thing, shouldn't I? If I really love Him, I'll do that. And if I find something in the Bible that's displeasing to the Lord, then I want to give that thing up, right? If I find that there's some little old thing I'm doing that irritates my wife and annoys my wife, I'm going to change. I don't want to make her unhappy. I love her. I want to make her happy. And so I'll adjust myself and change my ways if I know that it's something that'll make her more happy. Now, in the same way, the first question a converted, born-again Christian should ask is, Lord, what would you have me to do? Isn't that what Saul asked on the road to Damascus? When he was cut down there, the very first question he asked when he got up, he said, Lord, what do you want me to do now? Now, believe me, my friends, we ought not to be too antagonistic against doing things. Now, when we come to Jesus, we don't do anything to earn salvation. It's a free gift. We come to Him, and in His great love, He welcomes, receives, pardons, cleanses, takes us into His family. We cannot earn that. We can't do anything to deserve it. It's all free. We come and ask, and we're born again. But now, after we come into the family, we ought to begin looking around and searching for ways that we can show our love for Him. And that's what I'm going to do today. Now, don't misconstrue anything that I'm saying today. I'm talking to you assuming that you love the Lord, that you're a born-again Christian, that you're anxious to do everything you can. Now, somebody might say, well, now, wait a minute, Brother Joe. When you become a Christian, those things become automatic and spontaneous. You don't have to get up there and preach to us that you can't do this and can't do that, or that we ought to follow a certain kind of lifestyle or live according to certain standards, because all of this is just natural. It'll come through the Holy Spirit teaching us and telling us. Is that really true, friends? We don't have to be taught anything. When we become Christians, God will just reveal everything to us. Let me tell you, there are thousands of born-again Christians out there in those churches, and they're keeping Sunday every week. And the only reason they're keeping Sunday is that nobody ever taught them out of God's Word what God's will is. There are born-again Christians in those other churches that are not tithing, that smoke. And the only reason they're doing those things is that no one has taught them. Now, our business is to study the Word of God and the will of God and then to share it and talk about it and teach it to people so that we can learn what pleases the Lord. There's nothing legalistic in talking about standards. Now, we have very little in print on this subject of Christian standards. And I think that the reason is twofold. Number one, I think that many people are afraid to speak about Christian standards and lifestyles for the simple reason that the great majority of our people are living far below the great standard that's been set up, and they're afraid of talking about it for fear that they're going to embarrass somebody, a lot of people who are not living up to it. And number two, they're afraid that they will be labeled as judgmental or legalistic or lacking in that love relationship with Christ. Now, there's no reason in the world to feel that way, friend. These beautiful standards of the Bible fit in perfectly with righteousness by faith. There's nothing wrong with studying to find out how to please God and how to show our love for Him. So I'm not going to hesitate to share some things with you this morning. Now, what I'm going to share with you is going to be included in a new book that we're just having printed. In fact, it's about to go to the press right now, and within another month it should be ready. You probably read about it in a sheet in your materials there. It's called Creeping Compromise. And in there we've really tried to share some things that have never been shared before. Some of them haven't. You just don't read very much about some of these things that we talk about in the book. All right, now, let's ask this question. Why do Seventh-day Adventists need to study this subject anyway? Why do we need to understand about standards? You know, the devil has always had his special weapons to use against the people of God. You go back into the Old Testament and you'll find in every age and every generation, the old devil was there with some specially forged weapons that he used particularly against the people living at that time. I think about Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. God's people were there in those days. It was the Jewish people in the Old Testament, of course. They had the message of God, and they were the ones that Satan hated more than anybody else. And so he persecuted those people. You see, Satan has used that weapon of persecution a great deal against the saints. And he's going to use it again, of course. Down to the very end of time, you and I are going to become the objects of a great program of persecution. No doubt about it. But the devil has other weapons also that he has leveled against the remnant church and the people of God through the ages. And he's got a special weapon that he is using against Seventh-day Adventists, against the remnant church in these final hours of Earth's history. And it's a very effective weapon. It's going to do some terrible inroads upon the remnant church. Now let me ask you this question. What will be the final decisive issue as far as this world is concerned just before Jesus comes? What's going to be that very decisive, shaking, central issue that's going to divide people this way and that way? All right, it's going to be the Sabbath, isn't it? The mark of the beast is going to be enforced. And everybody in the world is going to either be on the side of the remnant church that are keeping commandments of God, or else they're going to receive the mark of the beast and they'll lay hold of the counterfeit pagan day of the sun. All right, now that's going to be the dividing issue that will bring every individual to a decision as to whether they're going to serve God and obey Him and honor Him by keeping all of His commandments, or whether they're going along with the expedient, convenient way and join the majority in breaking the law of God and breaking the Sabbath of the Lord. Now, how about Seventh-day Adventists? Now, that's the great test for the world. Now, it's going to be a test for us also, because you and I are going to be there in that day as the great objects of Satan's wrath. Remember in Revelation 12:17, it says, "A dragon was wroth with a woman and went to make war with a remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the faith of testimony of Jesus." Now, you and I are going to be the special objects of Satan's anger. He hates us, and that's why he's going to enforce the mark of the beast. That's why the death sentence will be brought against those who keep the Sabbath of the Lord. And we're going to have to stand up and be counted for God in the face of the death decree. Now, how many of God's people who are right now in the remnant church, how many are going to be faithful when they have to lay down their lives for the truth's sake? At least it will seem, at least, that they're going to have to give up their lives. How many do you think will stand firm and fast and faithful? All right. I want to read you something here. And this is really incredible to me. It's really, really incredible to me. I'm going to give you four statements from the Spirit of Prophecy right here. You might want to jot down the references. Volume 1, page 608. I would say that we're living in a most solemn time. In the last vision given me, I was shown the startling fact that but a small portion of those who now profess the truth will be sanctified by it and be saved. How many of those who are in the church are going to be saved? But a small portion. Now, another statement she made in Volume 5, page 136, she says, "The great proportion of those who now appear genuine and true will prove to be base metal." The great proportion. This other one said that only a small portion would be saved. Now that means that the majority of people who are in the remnant church are not going to make it through to the kingdom. They're going to drop out. They're going to give up. They're going to be shaken out. Now that's pretty alarming, isn't it? Here we sit today, and we look around in our group. And it's a solemn thing to think that the great majority of those who are right here today will not go through to God's kingdom. Now, if you should ask the ones who are here this morning, are you being faithful to God? Are you intending to remain true in the face of the death sentence? I think that 100% of those who are here would say, of course I am. I wouldn't give up this faith for anything. I'm going to hold on to it. No matter what, I'm going to be faithful. And yet we've just read here that we're not going to be. The majority are going to give it up, including, I assume, the majority of those right here. Now, how in the world is the devil going to do this? How is he going to trick us? How is he going to trick the majority of God's people today into giving up the truth and falling away and denying the truth when this great time of trouble comes? All right, now let me read the next sentence in this quotation as to why they're going to lose out at that time. I was shown the startling fact that but a small portion of those who now profess the truth will be sanctified by it and be saved. Many will get above the simplicity of the work. They will conform to the world and become spiritually dead. Now, you're going to notice as I read these texts, and by the way, the Bible writers also just repeat this thing over and over again. They tell us that we've got an enemy, and the enemy is the world. You remember that in the Bible over and over again? John said, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. For if you love the world, the love of the Father is not in you. Jesus said in John 15:19, if you were of the world would love its own, but the world hates you. You're not of the world. James 4:4 says, ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that friendship of the world is enmity with God? We go right on down, text after text after text. The writers of the Bible seem to have an obsession almost about declaring this deadly peril of mingling the world with the church. And so we're warned, come out from among them and be ye separate, saith the Lord. God's people be a peculiar people, zealous of good works. So there's to be a sharp line of demarcation between the Christian and the worldling. Now let me tell you, my friends, this is the devil's secret weapon that he's going to use against the remnant church in these last days to try to destroy the people of God. And the Bible warns us about it, and the spirit of prophecy warns us about it, that it's going to be the love of the world, it's going to be worldly things that will come in and cause millions to be lost. And yet, really, we're not hearing very much about it. As far as the world is concerned, the Sabbath test, the mark of the beast, is going to be the deciding factor. As far as you and I are concerned, it's what's going on right now. Whether we're going to stand or fall in that time when the crunch comes and when the death sentence is brought against us, it's being settled right now. It's being determined right now by what we're doing concerning the world. Now let me read the next quotation from Prophets and Kings, page 188. The time is not far distant when the test will come to every soul. The observance of the false Sabbath will be urged upon us. The contest will be between the commandments of God and the commandments of men. Those who have yielded step by step to worldly demands and conformed to worldly customs will then yield to the powers that be rather than subject themselves to derision, insult, threat, imprisonment, and death. At that time, the gold will be separated from the dross. Now, what is it that's going to determine whether we fall or stand in that day? She says, right now, those who are conforming to the world and allowing worldly customs to creep in, it's going to so dilute their Christian life and experience that when the crunch comes, they'll give up the faith and drop out. And my friends, this determination is being made right now, according to the way we're standing for Christ and refusing to yield an inch to the degenerate age around us and to the degenerate worldly customs around us. All right, another statement here from Great Controversy, page 608. As the storm approaches, a large class who have professed faith in the third angel's message abandon their position and join the ranks of the opposition. By uniting with the world and partaking of its spirit, they have come to view matters in nearly the same light. And when the test is brought, they are prepared to choose the easy, popular side. Men of talent and pleasing address who once rejoiced in the truth employ their powers to deceive and mislead the souls. They become the most bitter enemies of their former brethren. When Sabbath keepers are brought before the courts to answer for their faith, these apostates are the most efficient agents for Satan to misrepresent and accuse them. Why, this says that many of those who are now leaders in this church are going to be our accusers, turn against us and testify against us at the very end. Now, I'll tell you, my friends, this is not going to be easy to take, is it? This is not going to be easy to take. And when we see men that we've had great confidence in, men who taught us the truth, perhaps even, that'll turn against the truth at the very end of time and drop out, I say this is going to be a very, very hard thing to take. And yet the Bible says, by uniting with the world, by letting the world creep in, its customs, its fashions, and so forth, this is what's going to weaken the majority of our people so that they won't stand. Another statement, volume 5, page 463. The work which the church has failed to do in a time of peace and prosperity, she will have to do in a terrible crisis under the most discouraging, forbidding circumstances. The warnings that worldly conformity has silenced or withheld must be given under the fiercest opposition from enemies of the faith. You see, again, it says worldly conformity. That's a thing that's going to cause thousands of Seventh-day Adventists to be lost. Sister White said, it's the way's being prepared. It said these people are prepared by yielding little by little to the worldly customs. They're being prepared to fall and give up the faith and to be shaken out at the very end. Now, is this a serious matter, friends, or is it not? And yet we do not, how much do you hear, how many sermons do you hear about worldliness and a lowering of the standards and how the devil is changing our lifestyles and creeping in with his worldly customs? We don't hear a lot about it, friends. Now, there's a balance. We ought to be hearing the great doctrine of righteousness by faith that we're hearing. That's the most fundamental, basic thing that we can ever experience. But I want to tell you, we ought to go beyond that, and we ought to talk about some of these dangers that have been outlined for us. Thousands of pages in the Spirit of Prophecy are written about specifics of Christian conduct and Christian standards and lifestyles, admonishing us to be careful and draw lines and hold the line and keep the door closed against the intrusions of Satan, because these are the things that he's going to use to weaken us so that we will fail at the very end when the test of the death sentence comes. All right, another statement here now. This is from volume 5, page 216. Those who are uniting with the world are receiving the worldly mold and preparing for the mark of the beast. Now, it's all taking place right now. God's people all around us are bending very, very little by little towards the world, and they're being prepared to give up their faith. The devil will trick them into yielding up their separated lifestyle. And joining even against the truth at the very end. All right. They are preparing for the mark of the beast. And those who are distrustful of self, who are humbling themselves before God and purifying their souls by obeying the truth, these are receiving the heavenly mold and preparing for the seal of God in their foreheads. So there's a worldly mold and a heavenly mold that's right now being impressed upon God's people. And she says that the determining factor is the world. Those that are allowing the world to creep in, those are the ones that are going to be shaken out. Now, the question is this. If the majority of Seventh-day Adventists are not going to make it, they're going to give up the faith at the very end, and if right now they're being prepared to do that by the world coming into their lives and experience, you know what bothers me? You know the question that I have to ask myself every day? Am I bending with the majority of our people? Am I one of those majority group that is bending to the world and gradually allowing the world to come into my life? Now, obviously, friends, it's not going to be an open, obvious thing. Because if you ask the majority of our people today, do you think you're worldly? Do you think that worldliness has come into your experience in your life? The majority of our people say, well, of course not. Absolutely not. And I'm not going to give up my faith. Well, now, what does this mean? It means, really, that the majority of our people are worldly and don't even recognize it. Isn't that true? It means that the majority of our people are bending to the world and they hardly realize it at all, and they would deny it emphatically if you asked them. Now, that means that the devil must have a very clever way of doing it, right? He must be able to worm his way in in such an inconspicuous manner that we gradually are yielding the world and don't even realize it. And I say to you that it behooves us to sit down very, very often and compare our lives with the great standards of God's Word to find out whether the devil is making encroachments upon our experience and whether he's intruding with the worldly things into our lives. Now, according to what Jesus said himself, when this thing happens and the world gets in, it'll be a very, very inconspicuous way of doing it. Let's look at Luke 16 and verse 15. This is Jesus speaking. He said unto them, "Ye are they which justify yourselves before men, but God knoweth your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God." Now, did you get that last sentence? Listen to it. This is Christ speaking. "For that which is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God." In other words, the most popular and highly esteemed things in the world are the most deadly things that are abomination to God. Now, is it going to be easy for you and me to stand against the popular and highly applauded things of the world? The great church organizations are going to be there taking part in these highly esteemed things. The majority of God's own people will be doing it. And if we stand against those things and really hold up the standard that we ought to be holding up, we will be standing in diametric opposition to the recognized and taken for granted way of life that everybody's living in the world. And if we don't go along with it, do you know what we'll be called? Do you know what we'll be looked upon as? Listen to what Sister White said in Fundamentals of Christian Education, page 289. She says, "When we reach the standard that the Lord would have us reach, worldlings will regard Seventh-day Adventists as odd, singular, straight-laced extremists." Now, when we reach the standard that we ought to be living, my friends, the world is going to look upon us as a bunch of fanatics, because the popular lifestyle that is so highly esteemed, Jesus said, the world's going to say this is the greatest thing and the best thing, and we're told, Jesus said, that's the abomination in the sight of God. Well, now, do you think that it's something we ought to be studying and looking into, friends? It's very, very important that we study these things. So how's the devil going to do it? How is he going to call Seventh-day Adventists to give up their peculiar standards and lifestyles? I'll tell you something. He can't do it overnight. He'll never be able to do anything that will cause this church to suddenly turn around and give up its standards. We're not going to be announcing tomorrow or next week or next month, "Look, it's all right now for you folk to go ahead and go dancing and to go to the movies and drink tea and coffee and smoke cigarettes." We're not going to turn around and announce something like that. And the devil knows that he'll never be able to affect the remnant church like that, that we'll make any kind of a sudden reversal of our position on these standards. But I'll tell you something. The old devil is a master of psychological expertise. He's been experimenting with human emotions now for about 6,000 years, and he knows how to gradually work his way in and cause us to change without even realizing it, without even recognizing it. And the old devil's program of gradualism, by slowly getting us to change our standards, little by little, that's the way he's going to do it. That's the way he's already working. That's the way he's already accomplished something. In other words, the changes and the intrusions of the world will be so gradual and so slow and so almost imperceptible that people won't get alarmed by it. You know, they won't get excited about it. They don't feel like taking a position against it, because if they did, they would be considered fanatical. And after all, it would only be a very small little accommodation, only a small little compromise. And so most people, even though they might see that little compromise, they might see that little bit of worldliness coming in, they would still think, "Well, you know, I won't say anything now. I'll wait until there's a bigger issue. And then I'll really say something. I'll stand up and take a position on that thing." Let me tell you, there never will be any big steps. The devil makes certain of that. He only brings little things in, and they're so little, in fact, that most people don't even get excited. Now, a lot of our members, it disturbs them a little bit. They look at it and they say, that's too bad, really. I don't like to see that. But it's such a small little compromise that they don't want to take a position. They don't want to stand up and really make a big issue out of it for fear they'll be called fanatical. And so they wait until a larger issue. But there won't be one, friends. There will not be a larger issue. Listen to this. Satan will insinuate himself by little wedges, which widen as they make a place for themselves. The specious devices of Satan will be brought into the special work of God at this time. Now, Sister White says that the devil will come in by tiny little wedges, a little compromise, and then very slowly, you know, that thing will grow and grow and grow. Now, isn't this exactly the way miniskirts got into the church? Now, you just think about this for a moment. You look back. It's over with now. We can be thankful for that. At least most of it's over with, I guess. There'll always be an element of nudity, though, in modern styles and fashions. You can be sure of that. In fact, I want to talk about nudity here in just a minute because it's becoming more and more of it wherever we look. But you just think about this a moment now. How in the world did miniskirts ever get into the remnant church? If we had been back there 15 years ago or 20 years ago and somebody had shown us a picture of a woman in a miniskirt and should have told us as a group of Seventh-day Adventists that someday this is the way Seventh-day Adventist women would dress, that person would have been called crazy. They'd have said, no, you're crazy. No Seventh-day Adventist woman is going to wear a dress like that. Not with the standards we've got in the spirit of prophecy in the Bible. And yet we know it happened. We saw it Sabbath by Sabbath. Now, how did it get into the church? I'll tell you how it got in. Inch by inch. Just a little bit, you know. Some Seventh-day Adventist woman said, well, you know, if it's all right at the knee, you know, a half inch above the knee certainly is not going to be a sin. If it's modest at the knee, a half inch above is not going to be immodest. And nobody could argue with that, you know. Who could argue with that? And so the dress went up a half an inch. And then another woman looked at that and she said, well, you know, if that's not immodest, I know a half inch more wouldn't be a sin. Is that the way it happened, friend? Listen to this. Let me read you a statement when Sister White was talking about hoop skirts. Remember? Oh, no, you don't remember the hoop skirts. I mean, you remember the hoop skirts. All right. You know what they were, though, don't you? Great big hoop skirts, and when the ladies bent over to get into the carriages, you know, it was worse than a miniskirt. But here's what she said. She said, the power of example is great. Sister A ventures to wear small hoops. Sister B says, it's no worse for me to wear hoops than Sister A, and she wears hoops a little bit larger. Sister C imitates the example of Sisters A and B and wears her hoops a little larger than A and B, and all contend that their hoops are small. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? And so, somebody said, well, you know, if Sister A is wearing her dress an inch above the knee, I know another half inch isn't going to be a sin. So up it went. And although a lot of people were uncomfortable in the church and they looked around and thought, you know, that's not right. That shouldn't be. Yet it was so little that they thought, well, I'll wait until there's a larger issue. Then I'll really speak out. Very few people spoke out, my friends, until suddenly we woke up and realized one day what had happened. What had happened. The old devil had really put one over on us. And the amazing thing is how he did it, you know. How he did it. Very few people really challenged it because it came in so subtly. So subtly. I was going to read you a statement that Mary Quant made, the inventor of the miniskirt. I'm sure that some of you have read this. Here it is. Mary Quant was the French designer, I believe she was French, who invented the miniskirt. Here's what she said in an interview. She said, she was asked what kind of a person today's woman wants to be, and she said a sexual creature. She displays her sexuality instead of this coy business of hiding it. Today she dresses to say, I'm sexy. I like men. I enjoy life. Then Mary Quant made this bold statement. She said, many clothes are symbolic of those girls who want to seduce a man. Now, the woman who invented the miniskirt actually made that public statement. Now, would you imagine that any Seventh-day Adventist woman would ever wear the clothes after having the woman that made it say that it was made for the purpose of seducing a man? And yet, thousands and thousands of Seventh-day Adventist women wore them. And very little was said about it. Why? Because it gradually came upon us. Now, why didn't a lot of people say things? Let me read you a couple of statements from Spiritual Gifts, Volume 2, page 284. She says, I saw that individuals would rise up against the plain testimonies. It does not suit their natural feelings. They would choose to have smooth things spoken unto them and have peace cried in their ears. I view the church in a more dangerous condition than they've ever been. Experimental religion is known but by a few. The shaking must soon take place to purify the church. Preachers should have no scruples to preach the truth as it is found in God's Word. Let the truth out. I have been shown that why ministers have not been more successful, they're afraid of hurting feelings, fearful of not being courteous, and they lower the standard of truth and conceal, if possible, the peculiarity of our faith. I saw that God could not make such successful. The truth must be made pointed and the necessity of a decision urged. A lot of ministers even were afraid of saying too much about it because, I believe, for this very reason. For one thing, they were afraid that somebody was going to point at them and say, oh, you've just got an evil mind. That's why you think it's wrong. I've had a lot of people say that to me. Any time that a minister gets up and preaches about some of these violations of the laws of modesty, there's always going to be somebody saying, oh, you think it's wrong because you've just got an evil mind. You know, that's the way you look at it, and that's the way you think. And that scares a lot of people off. It scares a lot of preachers even. They don't want to be charged with that, and so they sort of keep quiet. Another statement Sister White makes, by some there is a shunning of the living testimony. Cutting truths must not be shunned. It needs something besides theory to reach hearts now. It needs a stirring testimony to alarm and arouse that will stir the enemy's subjects. Sins exist in the church that God hates, but they're scarcely touched for fear of making enemies. Opposition has risen in the church to plain testimony. Some will not bear it. They wish smooth things spoken unto them. And if the wrongs of individuals are touched, they complain of severity and sympathize with those in the wrong. When the church departs from God, they despise the plain testimony and complain of severity and harshness. It is a sad evidence of the lukewarm state of the church. That is from Spiritual Gifts, Volume 2, page 283. I'll tell you, friends, what the church needs today is men of courage who will really speak about some of these things and warn of dangers that are approaching. God says, the ministers are watchmen on the wall of Zion. He said, if they don't blow the trumpet when danger approaches, they're going to be held accountable for it. The blood of the people is going to be on them. And this is the only reason that I speak as I do, because I don't want to have to answer for anybody else's sins. God has set me as a minister to warn God's people when spiritual dangers approach, and this is a spiritual danger. Listen to this statement in Patriarchs and Prophets, page 578. Those who have too little courage to reprove wrong, or who through indolence or lack of interest make no earnest effort to purify the family or the church of God, are held accountable for the evil that may result from the neglect of duty. We are just as responsible for evils that we might have checked in others by exercise of parental or pastoral authority as if the acts had been our own. Now that says that if a minister sees some spiritual danger approaching the church and he doesn't get up and warn the people about it, and the people are led off into sin because of that danger, that the minister is going to be held just as guilty of it as though he committed those things himself. I'll tell you, that shook me up when I read that statement, and ever since I read that, I've not been reluctant to tell the truth to God's people. Because if I don't, God will hold me guilty of the same sins that they're committing if I do not at least warn them of these things. And that's why I'm sharing with you today, and that's why I've written this book that I've written, because I think, really, that too little has been said about these things. Sister White says, our only safety is to stand as God's peculiar people. We must not yield one inch to the customs and fashions of this degenerate age, but stand in moral independence, making no compromise with its corrupt and idolatrous practices. How has the devil wormed his way in? Has the church changed? Have standards changed? Have our living styles been affected by the prevailing customs and practices of the world around us? We can't deny it, friends. We have to say that it has. And many of us have pondered this thing, and we wonder, well, now, how far should I go? How much changing should I do? How much should I conform to the introduction of new styles and fashions, and where should the line be drawn? You know, a lot of people are afraid to talk about dress, for example, because what is modest and what is immodest? Everybody's afraid to define it. And it's true, it's very difficult to put a definition upon modesty or immodesty. But now let me ask you something, friends. Could we agree at least on this definition? All right, let's talk about dress for a moment now. Any kind of dress that a person might wear that would cause another person to sin, that would have to be wrong, wouldn't it? Can we agree with that? Now, whether you define it this way or that way, we can all agree at least that any kind of a dress that would make somebody else sin and lead them to harbor evil and impure thoughts, this would certainly be wrong. All right, now let's think of this. Long, long ago, Sister White made this statement. She said, "Fashion is deteriorating the intellect and eating out the spirituality of our people. Obedience to fashion is pervading our Seventh-day Adventist churches and is doing more than any other power to separate our people from God." Now, this was made a long time ago, before some of these modern immodest fashions came into existence. And she said fashion is, and obedience to fashion is doing more to separate our people from God than anything else. That is in volume 4, page 647. Now, let me say a word. I'm not talking about miniskirts particularly, but there are elements of in dress styles that are going to continue from now on that are going to be similar to what the miniskirt was. And I want you ladies to understand the result of wearing clothes that are provocative. I want you to understand it. So many women do not understand the principle involved in this thing. I've had many women just laugh it off, you know, when they were talked to about this subject of wearing dresses that expose their bodies. And they say, well, you know, that's just the dirty minds of the old man. I want you to know something today, my friends. It has nothing to do with the dirty minds of the old man. Every one of us has a carnal nature by birth. There's no question about that. But the struggle that men have in keeping their minds pure is not based upon having any more evil minds than anybody else, but it's based upon facts of creation. God made men different from women. And this is something that the women need to understand before they can fully understand why they shouldn't wear provocative clothing. I'll never forget, I had a crusade down in San Antonio, Texas a few years ago. This was back, in fact, about 4 or 5 years ago when miniskirts were very, very prevalent. And there was a man called me on the telephone in my motel room. He said, "Look, I've got to see you." He was a Catholic, a barber, and he'd been hearing my radio program every day for a year. He said, "I can't come out to your meeting because I'm a Catholic and I'm not supposed to do that, but I need some spiritual help, and I have confidence in you. I hear you broadcast every day. Could I see you in your motel room?" And I said, "Sure." We made an appointment, and this wonderful man came into my room there. He was a Catholic and a barber and a very faithful Catholic to his church. He said, "Look, I love the Lord. And I want to be saved. But," he said, "I got a problem. I don't know what to do about it." He said, "Women come into my barbershop all the time. And," he said, "they sit there with these miniskirts on. And," he said, "it brings evil thoughts into my head." He said, "I've struggled with it. I've fought it. I've prayed about it. I've wrestled and agonized over it." And he said, "I cannot keep my mind pure." He said, "Is God going to destroy me for that? And he broke down and wept. He cried. He said, "I don't know what to do." He said, "You've got to help me." He said, "How can I keep my mind pure? Is God going to destroy me because of these thoughts that I have in my head?" You know, the man, of course, was going through the same struggle that every man goes through. Now, by the grace of God, of course, we can claim the victory over anything. And God can give a man the victory over impure thoughts as well. But it's not easy because of the way the women dress. Now, what is the problem here? Let's come right down to it and lay it on the table now and not beat around the bush at all in it. God made men and women with a different sexual nature. And He did it deliberately. He did it in order to make marriage more pleasurable and more enjoyable. He created man with a sexual nature that is much more easily affected and stirred up, especially by the sight of nudity and the exposed body of the opposite sex. Now, God did this in order that man would be the aggressive one and the leader in the marriage relationship. He created woman with a much more subtle sexual nature that was not so quickly aroused by the sight of nudity, but was more easily stirred by the affections and so forth came into the conjugal relationship. Now, God made man and woman like this in order to make marriage more pleasurable, making man the leader and giving him a nature that would be more quickly aroused so that he'd be the leader in the marriage chamber. Now, God did not intend that man's more delicate, easily aroused sexual nature should ever be stirred outside the marriage chamber. In other words, He did not intend for man to look upon the naked body of women to stir up this sexual nature except within the confines of marriage itself. And in order to protect man, He created woman with a delicate sense of modest reserve so that she would keep her body covered and would not expose it except to her own husband. But you know, that plan was beautiful and it was perfect. But it has been spoiled today, as you very well know, because the devil somehow has been able to come in and actually destroy that delicate sense of modesty that God put into women. And today, as we look around in any direction, we see there the exposure of the body. Nudity is one of the marks and trademarks of this 20th century. And one cannot even walk down the road or the street without seeing it on every side. And it's an abomination. God never intended it to be this way, friends. What did Jesus say about it? He said that if a man look on a woman to lust after her, he's already committed adultery in his heart, right? Now, God said that to prove to us that man's mind is more easily affected by these things. He said it'll be easy for a man to think these thoughts of impurity. It'll be easy for him to commit adultery in his mind because of the nature he has. And so he'll have to protect himself by much prayer and by trusting in Christ and looking away from things that would be provocative of these evil thoughts. Well, I can guarantee you, my friends, that when women expose their bodies and as that dress creeps farther and farther above the knee, it does stir up evil thinking. And only by the grace and power of God can Christian men even look away and keep their minds pure. But for an unconverted man with a carnal nature, it is absolutely impossible for him to. Absolutely impossible. The very basest and most evil perverted thoughts will come into his mind when he looks upon those scenes of nakedness. So this is why women need to understand this. It may not stir up any thought at all in their mind, but they've got to be conscious of what it's doing to the mind of that man who is looking at them. And they're just as guilty before God as the man who commits adultery in his heart. According to the words of Jesus. Listen to this letter that Ann Landers printed in her column at the height of the miniskirt craze. Dear Ann Landers, here's a message from a dirty old man, age 22. I'm a college senior. The point of view I express here reflects the thinking of a lot of guys. There's nothing so ludicrous as a chick in a thigh-high mini sitting on a chair or sofa, tugging at her skirt, trying to pull it down to cover her status of respectability. She blushes 10 shades of red and asks with eyes big as saucers, am I sitting all right or is anything showing? If they don't want anything to show, why don't they buy a skirt with some material in it? More than once I've gotten a dirty look because I was caught popping an eyeball. Please tell the great pretenders who feign insult to come off it. The reason why they go half naked is because they want to create a little unrest. Tell them that act should have been canceled when they accepted the hike of the hem and said to blank with decency. Well, that's right. This was not a Christian writing. He was just a college senior. But he knew that there was a problem. And there is a problem, my friends. And I say that no Seventh-day Adventist woman should ever wear clothing that is provocative of stirring up these evil thoughts in the minds of man. Now, if you don't know what kind of clothing stirs up those thoughts, then you ought to sit down sometime and talk to some man that you have confidence in and that would be willing to lay things on the table and explain a few things to you. We've just said a little bit here today, and we can't go into it any further because of lack of time. All right. What else should we say here? I don't know how far to go today. Let me say just a little bit. Our time is almost up, in fact, here, and we've hardly gotten into it. Now, maybe I've stirred up your interest a little bit in this book. Because in this book, we go on and talk about... we talk about mixed swimming. We talk about unisex. Unisex you don't hear very much about these days. I heard Richard DeHaan on television here one Sunday morning not very long ago. I was having a crusade up in Nashua, New Hampshire there, and I had the TV on while I was shaving on Sunday morning, and suddenly I heard this man talking. He's some preacher on the radio. Don't know the name of his program. But anyway, he was talking about unisex. I never heard anything like it. I stopped and listened. First time I'd ever heard anybody talk about it in the way he did. It was something. I'll tell you, friends, there are dangers in this business of unisex. Very, very great dangers. I've got a chapter in my book on this. I want you to read that. And then we go on into television, music, diet, taking care of our body, divorce and remarriage. These are all very, very great spiritual standards, and we should know about them. Let's think just a minute about this business of mixed swimming, all right? Because to my way of thinking, and probably this is the last thing we'll be able to say here this morning, I wish we'd get into this unisex thing. I really do. Because it is a problem. Should we? Should we go to that rather than the other here? No. Did somebody say no? Huh? You don't know what unisex is? You never heard that? Okay. Somebody says they never heard the word. All right. Now, let me tell you what unisex is. It is a, everywhere I go, I see shops, unisex clothing, unisex hairstyles. In fact, I just saw the other day in one city, I passed by in one block where it says unisex boutique. And clothing, and then I went down a few blocks, and there was another said unisex hairstylist. Well, unisex is the idea that men and women, you know, should wear the same clothing, and that they should look alike just as much as possible. Of course, whether we call it that or not, that's what's happening, isn't it? There seems to be a drifting together here: the women becoming more masculine, men becoming more feminine. And this is the unisex movement today. Now, is there any danger in it? Let me ask you this. What is the cause for this mushrooming rise of homosexuality? Now, we've all been conscious of this. We've been reading about Anita Bryant down in Florida, and we've heard about these gay marches, you know, thousands and thousands of them, 5,000, 10,000 homosexuals marching down the street with banners and signs and placards, you know, pronouncing how proud they are to be a gay. It's something that never happened before. We can't believe it. It just happened in the last 5 years. And we say, what in the world's happened? They claim that there are 150,000 living in one city alone. I forget what city it was now. 150,000. Miami, I believe it was. All right. What is the cause for this? Most people don't know the reason for it. And they wonder, how did Sodom and Gomorrah get here into the 20th century? I believe, friends, that I know a little bit of why it's happened. I really believe that there are three factors today that have combined together to create this problem, this situation of perversion. Never before in history have we had these three things operating at the same time. Any one of them would not be serious. We would not even look at it a second time. But when we put the three things together, it's very, very alarming and shocking. Now, what are the three things? Number one, the women's lib movement, whose declared purpose is to interchange the roles of men and women in much of our social, economic, and religious life. All right, that's number one. The women's liberation movement today is very strong, very powerful. It's permeated the government and everywhere. Women demanding that they have an exchange of roles, that they do everything that the man does. All right, that's the first thing. Number two, the pantsuit fashion revolution that's led the majority of women to abandon traditional feminine dress styles. I think that's the second thing. The third thing is the growing tendency of men to dress in frills with feminine hairstyles and accompanying demasculinization. And I believe there were millions of borderline homosexuals. And all they needed was just a little bit of psychotic encouragement that these three things gave. And that pushed them across the line and put them into the camp of the confirmed homosexuals. Now, I'm not alone in believing this, friends. I'm not alone in it. Now, even God, even the Bible, speaks of these things in a way that makes this, I believe, an established fact. Now, notice in Deuteronomy 22, the children of Israel were going into the promised land to drive out those heathen tribes that were living there, remember? And as they went in we got to close in 2 minutes. But now, before they went in, that was the prevailing sin back in those days. Remember? Sodomy and homosexuality. That was the great sin of those heathen people back in the Old Testament. And what did God tell them in Deuteronomy 22:5 as they were going into the land? He said, "The woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are abomination unto the Lord thy God." All right, now God knew that this homosexuality often involved a wearing of the clothes of the opposite sex and becoming feminine or masculine, as the case might be. And so he told the people, he said, when you go in there, you keep the lines drawn clearly between the sexes. They're to dress according to their sex, and they're not to put on the clothes of the opposite sex. Go to the New Testament. You'll find there in 1 Corinthians 14, again, God said the man should not wear his hair like that of women. Women should not have their hair like that of men. There should be a difference. And do you know one of the greatest psychologists of our time has written a book called The New People, in which he says that this blurring of the lines of sexuality is going to spell the doom of civilization. He says this: the world can take anything except a loss of recognition of one's own sexuality. And he said, when those lines are blurred, then you get this homosexuality goes rampant. And he said, a nation can be destroyed by it. And he said that this country is about to be destroyed by the intermingling of these roles and the wearing of clothing of the opposite sex and so forth. Now, Sister White commented on this, by the way. Let me just give this, and then we're going to have to close. She says, in Volume 1, page 457, I was referred to Deuteronomy 22:5. The woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are abomination of the Lord thy God. Then she says this, there is an increasing tendency to have women in their dress and appearance as near like the other sex as possible, and to fashion their dress very much like that of men. But God pronounces it abomination. Now, notice that with her, it was not a question of women wearing men's clothing or women wearing men's clothing. She said when they fashion their clothes very much like the opposite sex, she said that's an abomination. Well, we're going to have to stop there. Time's gone. You'll have to get my book to read the rest of it, I guess. But it is a very serious matter and an important matter that we should be conscious of and that we should not allow to creep up on us again and to become another abomination. All right. Thank you. We'll be back together soon.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.